Bond Voyage QE2.
Ugh. The Fed's $600 billion stimulus program comes to an end.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, the last day of June.
And that was the last pun that you will hear.
I hope so.
Maybe. Coming up, we'll find out what happens to the economy without QE2 and whether it worked in the first place.
We've heard about the tech bubble that might be going on. What about some other bubbles we should be looking out for?
And the price of a Powerball ticket is about to double, but sales are also expected to rise. We'll explain that one.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll get to our top story in a moment, but first, news this morning from the Department of Agriculture that record-high corn prices have led farmers to plant the second-largest corn crop since World War II. Analysts say that could keep corn prices from rising any further over the next several months.
And the number of people filing for first-time jobless claims fell slightly last week. It's evidence that the economy, well, isn't mustering enough jobs.
Which is leading some people to be concerned about our top story today, Steve. It is the last day of June, which means it is the last day of the Federal Reserve's $600 billion bond buying program known as Quantitative Easing 2, or QE2 for short. The program was meant to boost lending and spending, get the economy going by injecting a lot of cash into it.
Yeah, well, we're going to get a couple of views now on QE2. First, let's turn to Peter Cohen, who has an economic consulting firm in New York, and he's with us now to explain it to us, to give us sort of a primer on quantitative easing. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Steve.
I want you to sort of scramble your brain for a second and imagine that you're talking to somebody on a talk show and not a business program. What do you tell them when they say, what the heck is quantitative easing?
It's giving money to people, including businesses and consumers, and it's coming through the Federal Reserve.
So giving money how, though? Are they just dishing it? Because I didn't get a check.
No, what happened was that the bond investors got a check, which were basically banks. Over the last 7 months or so, the Federal Reserve bought back $600 billion worth of bonds. So they're trading bonds, and in exchange for the bonds that they're buying back, they're putting cash into the hands of those investors who own the bonds. And here's the funny part. The banks turn around and invest that money in government bonds instead of lending it out. That's why it had no effect, because essentially it went from the Fed to the banks and back to the Fed again.
What were the long-term effects?
Well, they tried QE1. That worked a little bit better, actually stabilized the system. QE2 basically did nothing. And maybe in August, when they have their meeting in Jackson Hole, they might decide to come up with some new method for stimulating the economy. But the fact of the matter is that the key issue in this economy is coming up with 13.9 million jobs for all those people who are looking for work. And companies are doing just fine without hiring people. They had record profits in 2010. So basically, we're not solving the problem.
Maybe that refreshing air in Wyoming will inspire the Fed for something different? We don't know.
They probably will announce something in August.
All right, Peter Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Now let's dig into QE2 further with Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Diane, some people say that this QE2 program actually led to inflation. It drove oil prices higher and hurt the economy. Is there any truth to that?
Well, you know, you just pointed out the commodity prices tend to be self-correcting. The corn crop is one example of that. But there are so many factors pushing things like oil prices higher, most notably political unease and the Arab Spring in the Middle East. And it's hard to pin the Fed on that. And I think that's a very important issue, is to understand how complex these markets actually are.
Well, so do you think that if some of the big problems around the world get worse, or right in Washington with this debt ceiling debate, that the Fed would step in again later with a QE3?
I think the threshold for the Fed to do additional stimulus at this stage of the game is much higher than many on financial markets are giving them credit for. It would take nothing short of a double-dip recession. Now, if the debt ceiling is failed to be lifted and that triggers another panic, perhaps even worse than what we saw in the wake of Lehman, it would be Lehman on steroids, I think, as some people have pointed out. That is something we'd have to really worry about, and the Fed would certainly step in at that stage of the game.
Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks as always.
Thank you.
All right, now to another program, this one from Congress that's also aimed at boosting the economy, specifically by getting more banks to lend money to small businesses by handing over billions of dollars in cheap funds to community banks. And as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, some experts want to know why bailed out banks are lining up for another bailout.
Small businesses keep complaining that stubborn banks are holding back the recovery, making it hard to borrow startup funding or money for inventory or payroll. So lawmakers came up with a plan that sounded straightforward.
Bolster the capital available to community banks so that they can then lend to small businesses.
That seemingly simple plan, outlined by Republican Sam Graves, who chairs the House Small Business Committee, has gotten complicated. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was on Capitol Hill last week trying to explain why only a third of the $30 billion available has been requested by the banks.
We do not have the capacity, and the program does not give us the ability to force banks to lend.
Critics say the program is flawed. They say the way it's set up is most beneficial to hundreds of small banks already on the hook for money from the big Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. They can quietly use this money to get out from under the stigma and tough restrictions of the first bailout.
It looks like almost every single one of those TARP banks that could possibly qualify for the program have applied.
NYU Professor Neil Barofsky is the former Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. He says if the banks repay their TARP debt now through this more favorable government program, taxpayers get the short end of the deal. The banks contend their borrowing costs only go down if they boost their small business lending by at least 10%. But Barofsky points out the supposed incentive is actually retroactive to last year.
For the TARP bank that just naturally increased lending as a result of the economic recovery, for having done nothing other than enjoying the benefits of TARP money and their normal course of business, they're going to get a huge windfall reduction in what they have to pay the government, which is just not good from a taxpayer perspective.
Professor Linus Wilson has studied this issue at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He says government leaders have special motivation to move banks out of the controversial TARP bailout.
It'll make the numbers of the TARP look a lot better than it really is.
Wilson says they can claim a lot more banks emerge successfully from TARP, even if those troubled banks really just switch to another kind of government aid. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Some good news this morning from the Institute for Supply Management. It turns out that business activity in the Midwest grew more than expected this month, and that's keeping markets happy.
Happy today, at least at the time of our broadcast.
That's
for
right.
The podcast. We've got more numbers, by the way. You can check them out anytime, 24 hours a day, at our website, marketplace.org.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Today, bullet trains begin running in China from Beijing to Shanghai in what is now the world's longest high-speed rail network. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz compares the Chinese lines to what we have going on here in the United States.
So let's say you live in Chicago and you want to take the Amtrak to New York. If the train's on time, it'll take you 18 hours. Beijing to Shanghai is around the same distance. On the new bullet train, that's a five-hour trip. Just like with everything else these days, China's faster.
China understands correctly that you need to make a big investment in sustainable transportation if you're going to be competitive in the 21st century.
Robert Cruickshank writes the California High-Speed Rail blog.
Here in the U.S., we're simply not willing to go ahead and make that investment, or at least our Congress isn't, without realizing that if you don't invest in the future, well, you're not going to have one.
The U.S. government has set aside $7 billion for high-speed rail. China's central government has invested $309 billion. It's taken China around 5 years to build that network. Cruickshank says funding problems and environmental regulations mean a 15 to 20-year wait in the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Today, Washington State will cut costs by closing its official tourism agency. That'll make it the only state in the country to abandon all funding for self-promotion. Comes at a time when tourism is one of the fastest-growing economic sectors in the world. Vanessa Romo of KPLU has the details.
For years, Washington has linked the image of playful orca whales flopping around the Puget Sound with the perfect family summer vacation. Marcia Massey is executive director of Washington State's tourism office, at least until the end of the day.
Unfortunately, when the legislators are having to make really difficult decisions around things like education and social services, everything was on the table, and tourism was one of those items that was on the table.
Across the country, about half the states are cutting their tourism budgets, but other states are investing millions more into luring new customers.
I hate to say this, but I think it's an opportunity for us in Colorado to pick up market share. If you don't tell your story, people won't show up.
That's Al White of Colorado's tourism office. He says back in 1993, the state pulled its marketing dollars with disastrous results.
Our share of the tourism industry shrunk by one-third in 4 years after not spending anything to market ourselves.
In Seattle, I'm Vanessa Romo for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, the New York Times today did this in-depth expose on home paint.
Hmm.
Yes, yes. I think
like
everyone
painting
should,
your walls
absolutely,
in your house.
Absolutely. That kind of paint, sure. And how paint companies are trying to sell more paint in a slumping housing economy. You know, fewer people are doing remodeling.
Oh, yeah.
There's not a whole lot of money in the housing market.
Not buying as much paint.
Right, not as much paint going on there. So these companies are giving colors an added descriptive splash, if you will. For example, Valspar now sells one shade of orange. Well, it used to be called apricot 1 through 6, right? There were different shades of apricot.
Yeah.
Now it's called Weekend in the Country. Doesn't that sound nice? Benjamin Moore sells Rendezvous Bay. It's,
wow.
It's basically turquoise,
that
like
really
a blue-green color.
Paint. Yeah,
Rendezvous
absolutely.
Bay.
Right.
Isn't that right. nice? Even Ace Hardware. Remember the helpful hardware man, Ace?
Yeah.
They've gotten into the act as well with a beige color known as, get this, Hey There. It's just called Hey There, or as I like to call it, paint.
Yeah, that's a good, you should get into the paint business, Steve, and just come up with names.
Add another online company to the list of companies that might go public this year. This time it's Living Social, the big daily coupon website. And all these IPOs, these initial public offerings, have some people talking about a big tech bubble.
But Steve, forget about the tech bubble, because Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell says there are other bubbles that we should be paying attention to.
It's like the Lawrence Welk show around here, all these bubbles.
Chris Farrell joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, give me the latest from Bubble Land. Chris, what are you watching for?
As the kids of boomers go off to college, I just want to paraphrase Shakespeare. They'll be reading Shakespeare. Or maybe I'm going to abuse Shakespeare. But it's bubble, bubble, toil, and trouble.
Yeah.
Here's what's happening. You know, the past quarter century, tuition and fees risen three times the rate of individual family income. And we've been making up that gap more and more, particularly when it comes to private independent colleges and public universities with debt. And I got to tell you, Jeremy, the lesson of the past several years is too much debt, too little income equals financial trouble. College education will still pay off in the future. The question is, how much debt do you use to finance it? And I think people need to retreat from that. That bubble is going to burst.
So maybe a bubble there with the boomers having driven up the cost of college, and now it might come down. What other bubbles are you watching, especially when it comes to the boomers or their kids?
Well, I think we've seen two other bubbles about, they may burst. Retirement for everyone. Social Security, Medicare, buy that RV, head down south. What is the lesson of two bear markets and two recessions in less than a decade? It's actually going to work a lot longer. Hmm. Forget the RV, get yourself back to work. Here's the other bubble. This bubble is when the boomers retire, we've been adding stocks. We've been buying stocks. We've been told to have stocks in our 401k plans. When we retire, we sell it and the stock market goes bust.
So you see these bubbles all busting soon?
The last one I don't see, and here's why. 1 billion Chinese, they're going to buy our stocks. The Indians, they're going to buy our stocks. The emerging markets is going to bail out the baby boomer when it comes to their stock portfolios.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And finally, Steve, to East Hampton, New York, where someone claims to have found an ATM receipt showing an account balance of $99,864,000. $1,731.94.
It's mine. I knew I dropped that thing somewhere.
Well, it's unclear who it belongs to, but whoever it is took out just $400 on this occasion.
Well, according to
a photo of the receipt.
For them to take out most of that
money.
I wonder if you have
a $99 million balance, do you have a higher amount of cash that you're allowed to take out at any one time? You might still be locked into the $500 limit.
Yeah.
But the person apparently is not concerned with ATM fees. He or she shelled out $2.75 to use the out-of-network ATM.
You know, I shared that story with Jill Schlesinger, who joins us on Friday. She'll be on this podcast tomorrow. And she said to me, she said, because she has a home on the Hamptons, and she said to me that most of their ATMs over there don't even give out 20s. They give out 50s. I was like,
so,
wow.
Yeah, it's, well, then $2.75. Maybe they should up it to $4.75 for a fee.
Don't give them ideas. Man.
Well, you know, I have to say, I don't really buy this story. I think this ATM photo is fake.
I do too.
You can judge for yourself at marketplace.org. We've got a photo of the receipt, and tell us if you think it's real. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.